Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Grant Williams Podcast. Joining me in a second is Chris Joy of Coolabah Capital down in Australia. I've been following Chris for a number of years now and have been just really fascinated by his approach to covering not just Australia, but the entire world as a fixed income manager based in Australia. Chris has a really, really good way of framing his arguments. He's come up with some incredibly prescient calls over the last couple of years, and I've wanted to talk to him for a long time. So finally, we've managed to get this together. I had a few technical issues, and Chris was incredibly patient with me while we got those sorted out. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Chris Joy. Chris, welcome to the podcast, mate. Before we get into the stuff I want to talk to you about today, perhaps you can, for the benefit of those outside Australia who don't know you as well as those inside Aussie, you could give us a little quick potted background, and then I want to jump into some of the interesting things going on in the world.
Yeah, sure. I started off at Goldman Sachs in London and then Sydney. I worked for the RBA. After that, I studied at Cambridge University, where I set up a quant fixed income business. I sold that to Macquarie Bank in 2010. And in 2011, I set up a quant global fixed income manager, Coolabah Capital. We run about $6 billion US. We run global long-short strategies and long-only strategies, absolute return and benchmark-aware strategies. I have about 40 staff, 9 in London. We have 12 traders and 12 analysts. We have an opportunistic market-making style. So we're typically buying and selling probably 300 to 500 million a day, 50 to 100 trades a day. We have a very, strong quantitative focus, just looking for mispricings in global high-grade bond markets. So we're not so focused on the liquids or high yield. That's, probably a fair primer, mate.
Perfect. And you also write a very well-regarded column in the Aussie Financial Review, which is kind of must-read for everyone down there in Sydney. That's certainly how you first came to my attention.
Yeah, I do. And that it's kind of an interesting discipline being forced to put into a newspaper in black and white every single week of your life,
yes,
your view of the world. But yeah, it can be cathartic and also challenging.
Well, yeah, because you're obviously, it's right there in black and white, as you say, the record of everything you've said, everything you've done. And obviously people love to pick up on any kind of bad calls you make and never give you the kudos for the good ones you get right.
That's right.
Part of the game, I guess. Well, listen, the reason I wanted to talk to you, I listened to you talk to David Clark on a podcast a couple of months ago, and you had some very, very interesting things to say from a really broad macro perspective about profound changes to the world in which we're all forced to invest. And you made a lot of points that I've been trying to articulate. You articulate them much better than me. So what I'd love to do, if we can, to kick off, is perhaps if you can just give us a kind of overview of those profound changes, how the world has changed and why those changes are so important for investors to understand and adapt to.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I just think in summary, the asset allocation that we've been conditioned to for the period from, say, 2008 to 2022 is obviously entirely inappropriate for the present period and that which we face going forward. And I think my observation, which is not novel, is obviously that, you know, we've moved from the zero interest rate world or the near zero cash rate world and the policy reflex of slashing that cost of capital at the first sign of stress and running QE to infinity and trying to pour money on problems as, you know, a perfect panacea, which was inexorably going to give us an inflation crisis. The precipitate this time was the pandemic, and I think that was amplified obviously by unprecedented fiscal and monetary policy stimulus in response to that particular crisis, which then gave us the mother of all inflation challenges, which has in turn propagated these very high cash rates, long-term interest rates, and a massive increase in the discount rates that are used to value all assets. And we're now watching, I think, a very slow and iterative adjustment process. The adjustments have happened really fast in liquid asset classes, like high-grade bonds. It's debatable as to how much of the adjustment has been transmitted through to equities, which still look, I think, very dear on many measures. And the adjustment's incredibly slow in illiquid asset classes, like commercial real estate, residential property, private debt, high-yield bonds. You know, we've seen high-yield bond spreads remain incredibly tight at below long-term historical average levels. And they're probably sitting at, you know, half the levels you would expect, given we're in the biggest default cycle globally since the 08 crisis. We have US bankruptcy filings right now running at the highest level since 2010. And monetary policy is slowly but surely asphyxiating many parts of the economy with varying degrees of success, because one of the novel features of this cycle is the advent of these enormous consumer cash buffers that people saved during the pandemic when we locked down cities and when we effected huge cash transfers to businesses and households. So they need to be burnt through. That's a new, never before seen, in a sense, source of demand and inflation. And that's probably why global economies have been more resilient to rate hikes than many, you know, otherwise supposed. But I think it's quite radical and profound, as you say, the changes we face today. I personally think it's going to be a very long adjustment process. And it absolutely has, you know, crazy consequences for portfolio construction and optimal asset allocation.
Well, let's talk about that, because this idea that it's a long process, I'm curious to dig into that, because you know what we've had for the best part of 15 years now is a world that was completely unsustainable. You know, I think we all knew that rates couldn't stay at zero forever. We all kind of knew that excessive valuations were being created right across the investment spectrum by these low rates, and we knew it was unsustainable. But what we now have in this profound new environment that you just described so beautifully is something that doesn't work. Right, with rates where they are right now, with 5% in cash rates and the short end of the curve, very attractive. As you say, CRE cap rates way too low. We see a world that doesn't work. And so the adjustment for unsustainable, to me, is a process. It dawns on a few people at a time, and eventually we get the correction we're seeing. But a world that doesn't work, I'm curious as to how you think this ultimately resolves itself, this particular high rate, high valuation world that we find ourselves in now.
Yeah, well, I would first challenge the statement that we knew it was unsustainable. I think, you know, entire generations of investors have firstly become conditioned to the idea that, you know, labor markets would be fully employed, money would be perpetually cheap, and so forth. The Pimcos of the world were coining the notion of a new normal that would be characterized by the low rates for long paradigm. We had vast swathes of the economy predicate their business models on the availability of ultra-cheap money. You know, on our analysis, we saw a huge increase in the share of listed companies in the US, Europe, and in Asia and the UK that didn't have sufficient income to service their interest repayments on their debts. So, you know, over the last decade, that's risen from around 5% of listed firms globally to close to 15% of listed companies in what represents, you know, the rise of these zombie entities that, as you rightly point out, can't survive necessarily in a high rate climate. So I think much of the community, you see it through the advent of cryptocurrencies that were very successful when cash deposits paid no return. I think, you know, lots of very smart and successful people bought into that view of the world, that that was the status quo. Interest rates were going to be very, very low forever. I remember sitting at dinner one night with the top trader from Citigroup, who said to me that he thought he would never see central banks raise rates during his lifetime. But obviously other people, such as yourself and myself, you know, may have had differing perspectives on the sustainability of those processes. But as to how it plays out right now, Grant, like the first thing I'd say is no one really knows. It almost defies comprehension, the complexity of the financial system. I would say that our sense and central case is characterized as follows. The first thing is that labor markets, despite, you know, record interest rate increases around the developed world. We've now had 525 basis points of interest rate increases from the US Federal Reserve and similar increases from the Bank of Canada, the Bank of England. The ECB is not, you know, far behind with its 4.3% policy rate. You know, in New Zealand, the cash rate's 5.5%. In Australia, it's 4.1%. So I think the first point is that the reaction of the domestic economy to those rate increases has, you know, obviously been surprisingly resilient, because we see global unemployment rates around 3.5% to 4%, well below estimates of the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment, or the so-called full employment level of the jobless rate, where the economy is sort of, you know, operating at equilibrium. Wage growth remains very, very elevated, much more disturbing than sort of nominal wages running at 4% to 5% across much of the developed world. Is the fact that when you look at labor productivity and you subtract that from nominal wage growth, and it sounds very wonky, but you examine something called unit labor costs, or what we refer to as just unit wage costs, and that is the wage cost of businesses producing products. Unit wage growth or unit labor costs are increasing in Europe at a rate of 6 to 7%, very high rates in the UK, in the US at 5 to 6%. In Australia, around 8%, in New Zealand, about 7.4%. And this measure, this particular variable, nominal wages less labor productivity, is one of the key, if not the key variable, central banks use to forecast inflation. And current rates of unit labor cost growth are highly, highly inflationary. And this is what's exercising central banks, I think, around the world. So that's now manifesting in very inert or stubborn and sticky services or demand side inflation. Again, in Europe, the US, and in Australia, New Zealand, all running at circa 5 to 6% on a 3-month and 6-month annualized basis. Goods inflation has obviously subsided as supply chains normalize, but most central banks are not forecasting getting back to their targets until 2025 or 2026. And obviously, there's tremendous uncertainty around those forecasts. So I think all we would say is that the expectation in early 2023 that the Federal Reserve would cut rates by 100 basis points, which was what was priced in the bond markets, which I think was a key catalyst for the risk rally in 2023. This idea that the hiking cycle was over, the damage was done, you know, the Goldman Sachs narrative around we were going to thread the needle, apropos a soft landing. That part of that narrative, in terms of certainly the Fed cuts, has been eviscerated. So the Fed's obviously not going to cut rates this year based on everything we know and understand today. And the market shifted those cuts into 2024. But our central case is that rates will likely remain higher for a number of years. Our concern is that financial markets are not really pricing in any probability of an increase in rates. Most of these hiking cycles are punctuated by pauses that are then superseded by hikes. If I take a local example, if you look at the Reserve Bank of Australia, you know, between 2002 and 2008, it hiked over a long period of time, paused four times. Three of those pauses were for 12 months or more, only to be followed by hikes. And what concerns me is this current challenge where we have super tight labor markets. We haven't seen much labor market capitulation. We have very elevated wage growth, but we have particularly poor labor productivity. And the reason we have poor labor productivity, which I think, Grant, everyone gets wrong, it's not because, you know, all the listeners on this podcast are working very hard. We're all wired with supercomputers on our wrists and in our hip pockets. We've got better information and technology than we've ever had in our lives, better access to insight. We all accept that. So we're personally very productive. But if you look at the labor load borne by businesses, and particularly, you know, with the rise of re-regulation, compliance, diversity, ESG, the woke movement, if you look at banks, for example, the compliance departments, risk departments, legal departments, government affairs departments, ESG departments, human resources departments, they've all exploded in size within global banks. And they're the biggest employers in the world in many countries, the banks. And so if you look at the definition of labor productivity, which is output per hour worked, we are producing similar products with many more people. That's obviously also manifest in very, very low unemployment rates. And I think the canary in the coal mine was Elon Musk, who, you know, rocks into Twitter and he sacks 80% of the workforce and is arguably producing a better product today. You can have a debate about that, but he's definitely producing the same product or a similar product. So this is the issue we face. We have very secular challenges with labor productivity, which is highly inflationary. And that suggests that this inflation crisis will be an iterative multi-year battle, which means we're stuck with high discount rates for a long time. Our modeling still implies that the US goes into recession in late 23, early 24. We've been saying that since January 2022. Europe's just had two quarters of negative GDP growth. New Zealand's just had two quarters of negative GDP growth. All the central banks of the world all want to increase their unemployment rates to their NAIRUs or beyond their NAIRUs, which would meet the NBER definition of a recession. And so I think the world we face is a very difficult one. We're going to face a tremendous amount of adversity. And I think asset classes have to undergo huge adjustments as they reprice or re-rate to a world in which government bonds are paying 4 to 5%, bank deposits are paying 5 to 6%, bank bonds are paying 6 to 7%. And if more or less riskless senior ranking and tier two bank bonds are paying you 6 to 7% interest rates, everything else on planet Earth needs to pay you a 3 to 5% risk premium above that to account for their illiquidity, credit default, and loss risks. And the problem is that commercial property equities, private equity, venture capital, infrastructure, private debt, and high yield are not doing that. And neither is resi property. So these are massive cross currents and massively interesting. It means, as we've discussed, huge shifts in asset allocation, defined benefit pension funds of the world that were running funding deficits for decades and loaded up on risk to close those deficits. The promises they made to pay to their members are valued in present value terms. And when interest rates skyrocket as they have, the value of those liabilities has fallen. So many defined benefit pension funds are now running these huge surpluses, which they can only lock in by buying high-grade fixed-rate bonds, which they're now slowly but surely doing. And we're seeing this actually in Australia, which of any country in the OECD had the highest weight to equities amongst its pension funds and the lowest weights to cash and fixed income. And, you know, a $300 billion pension fund like Australian Super, which basically had no cash and bonds, is now saying the only thing it's investing in is cash and bonds. So these are massive first and second order influences on the value of all assets.
It's amazing. It's such a great picture of the world we currently find ourselves faced with, Chris. And I wonder, you know, as this kind of works itself through, we talk about this potential recession in the US in fourth quarter this year, first quarter next year. What happens at that point? Because obviously previous recessions, there hasn't been this inflation bugbear on the other side, keeping the central banks honest and tying one hand behind the back. They've been able to cut rates. They've been able to use low interest rates and low cost of capital to juice things. What happens this time around, do you think? Because that's not really something that they can do without consequence anymore.
Yeah, so I think the power of capitalism has always been creative destruction, by which we mean market signals have rewarded good businesses and punished bad businesses. And the best thing that happened to the global economy in some senses was the 87 crash followed by the 91 recession, which, you know, as you would understand and I would understand in countries like Australia and the United Kingdom, was particularly severe. But what that did was like a bushfire ravaging a natural landscape. It kind of destroyed the weak and rewarded the strong. And you had a tremendous spurt of global productivity in the 1990s as capital and labor was reallocated from bad businesses to good businesses. And with the advent of the global financial crisis in 2008, we basically stymied that process. And for the first time in a very, very long time, central banks brought out these new novel tools, this idea that they could disintermediate freely moving financial markets. They could reject price signals. They could basically stifle creative destruction and ultimately could set their own prices by buying everything, government bonds, bank bonds, corporate bonds, equities, and in the case of the Japanese, real estate investment trusts, because they wanted to set their own cost of capital and their own market prices. But that obviously, you know, has a consequence, which is stymieing innovation and productivity. And they could only do that because there wasn't a binding constraint in the form of high inflation. So we had, you know, massive policy innovation and proliferation. I think this time around, what we should all hope for is one of those cathartic creative destruction moments where we do get significant reallocations of capital and labor away from the 10 to 15% of all listed firms that before interest rates increased in early 2022 and late 2021 in some economies like New Zealand, before these interest rate hikes on FY 2021 financial data, we had 10 to 15% of all listed firms that were zombies, that didn't have enough income to pay the interest on their debts. And the key culprits were sectors like real estate, healthcare, communications, technology, and some resources firms. So I think this time around, all the central banks of the world seem to miss the permanence and persistence of the inflation shock. We had the transitory inflation thesis that was rolled out during 2020 and 2021. But as you rightly point out, Grant, I think it was obvious to some. You know, I won't necessarily claim any particular prescience, but I'll tell you that my economists in late 2021 presented detailed modeling and PowerPoint presentations in which they argued that the Federal Reserve needed to lift its cash rate to 5 to 6%. This was in December 2021 when the Fed was at zero and bond markets were arguing, or, you know, through their prices, that the Fed's cash rate would not exceed much beyond 1%. So my guys were saying, you know, they need to get to 5 to 6%. And I thought that was pretty confronting at the time. Publicly, we argued in late 21 the Fed needed to go to north of 3%, which was highly contrarian, and that the US 10-year government bond yield needed to exceed 3.2%. Of course, today it's over 4.3% at the time of this recording. And they argued that in countries like Australia, that the RBA needed to lift its cash rate from zero to north of 4 to 5%. My guys have always been proponents of the view that we would struggle with sticky services or demand-side inflation driven by unit labor costs, and that's where we find ourselves today. And I think the central banks are really scarred by this moment because it is an existential crisis. As you know, and many listeners would know, if they lose control of inflation expectations, you will get a wage-price spiral. I think there's evidence to believe that we do already see wage-price spirals around the world where wage claims are being linked to movements in the consumer price index. In the UK, you know, the last wage print was 8.2% year-on-year, sort of around where inflation has been running. In Australia, the federal government just agreed to increase the minimum wage by, surprise, surprise, 8.1%. And what we call award wages by 5.8%, and that affects 20 to 30% of all workers. So I think this time around, the central banks are going to let markets clear, and they're going to want to see a significant increase in unemployment. They want to kill bad businesses. That's their explicit aim, is to destroy demand, kill bad businesses, create job losses, and ensure that they can crush wage growth, unit labor costs, and improve productivity. And what policymakers don't say, Grant, when they talk about the need to improve productivity to help reduce inflation, you know, they often talk about investing in technology and capital equipment. They talk about improving our human capital through training and education. What they never say is the best way to improve productivity is to increase unemployment, to produce the same quantum of products with fewer people. And that's really the mission here. So I don't see them making the same mistakes over and over again. I think if we get a recession, that's all well and good, but they'll want to have absolute certainty that not only is core inflation, and particularly you can see the Fed pivoting to talking about services inflation, demand side inflation, they want to see all those variables locked in at 2%, and they'll want to know for certain that we're not going to repeat the mistake that central banks made in the 60s, 70s and 80s where they cut preemptively only to lose control of those inflationary processes and to confront wage price spirals. So I think it's a multi-year battle. I think it's going to be incredibly painful. I think illiquidity is going to be punished and risk is going to be punished. And I think the only places to hide are cash and very, very high-grade fixed income and all being short.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting because, you know, you use the word confronting when those guys, when your economists came to you with that 5% target. And I can only imagine if they're back in 21, that sort of number would have been confronting to just about everybody. I mean, I think most people were sitting there saying the Fed would never get to 3% without something material breaking. But, you know, as you say, here we are, 5.25%, and other central banks around the world being dragged up in its wake. But this idea that they now need to impose a recession is an interesting one for me, because I think you're absolutely right. But there is such a political trade-off now. Previously, when we had the crisis in 2008, you know, we were all told that unless we did this, the system is going to go down. In the end of 2018, when we had the bond market wobbles, they just cut in the face of pressure in equity markets falling, you know, Christmas Eve and around about the end of the year in 2018. This time, as I said, they don't have that luxury. And even though they want and they actually need to generate this recession and they need to crush all these things, heading into an election year in the US particularly, what kind of chance do you give them of being allowed to do what they need to do to get this under control before vested interests step in and say, all right, we're going to actually take the ball away from you now, because what you're doing, even though maybe what you need to do, does not play well politically, does not play well socially, and is going to amplify the tensions we already have?
Well, you raised so many interesting points, mate. Like, I don't remember anyone talking about 5 to 6% Fed funds rates in 2021. Maybe Larry Summers was out there saying something similar. I remember thinking my economists were a little bit nutty that they were sort of inflation zealots, but they really called the cycle particularly well. And I was very, very hawkish myself at the time, arguing for like a 3% plus cash rate. What I think I missed in 2022 in terms of the speed and the sheer severity of the pace of the hiking cycle was actually the opposite of what you're talking about, which was that initially the politicians, having created central banks that were independent such that they could absolve themselves of responsibility for fighting inflation. And, you know, that's, I think, much the reason we have independent central banks is so, you know, the polity can point the finger at other people. And so, you know, I think the reflex at the time for many politicians was, well, this is the central bank's problem. They've got this wrong. They talked about this transitory thesis. It failed to materialize. And we're now dealing with an entrenched inflation crisis. So go fix the problem. And they've blamed the central banks initially. And unwittingly, I think in doing so, they created a perfect storm by giving the central banks, you know, which have been bred on the inflation fighting Kool-Aid since the advent of these so-called inflation targeting regimes pioneered by the RBNZ in the early 1990s, they've given their political imprimatur to ultra-aggressive rate hikes, which, you know, once that door was opened, all the central bankers rushed through it. And then suddenly we're dealing with, you know, 500 plus basis points worth of hikes. And that really surprised me, mate, because I thought that the hiking cycle would be slower and more drawn out precisely for the reasons you've articulated. I thought, you know, these highly myopic and hedonistic politicians would throw sand in the wheels of the hikes and resist the hikes at all costs. I didn't quite initially in 21 and early 22 create the connection between the inflation crisis being actually an imminent political problem that everyone would want to, you know, deflect to the bureaucrats, which is what transpired. But of course, once the consequences of these incredibly aggressive hikes have become clear, and they've started reverberating through the real economy, I think the politicians are now slowly but surely reverting to type and starting to resist where they can these changes. And you're seeing it in Bidenomics. I mean, remarkably, the US is running a budget deficit that on our estimates is right now about 8% of GDP. So we've got this incredibly stimulatory and inflationary fiscal policy that's being run by President Biden in the US, which is working in direct opposition to the Fed's extremely tight monetary policy. Of course, we've now got the contemporary debate that's just popped up onto the radar screen, which the New York Fed contributed to, which is the question of, well, where is the normal or so-called neutral interest rate? So the Fed has argued that a neutral is, you know, 2.6%. And the latest research coming out of the New York Fed has suggested, well, it actually might be 3.8%. And so therefore, you know, a 5.25 to 5.5 Fed fund rate is not nearly as restrictive as perhaps people have assumed. And that research is really drawing from the real economy response to rates. But again, I'd stress that this monetary policy cycle is quite unlike any other we've ever seen. We've never started with zero rates before. We've never started a hiking cycle with lower unemployment. We've never started a hiking cycle with this triumvirate of super low unemployment, super high core inflation, zero interest rates. And then to overlay the other innovation here, which is this pandemic where households were shut down and could not spend. So you had record savings rates amplified by massive, unprecedented fiscal transfers of cash, cold hard cash to households and businesses. And so you had these huge consumer buffers. In Australia, we estimate the consumer buffers were worth about 20% of annual household income, and they were very evenly distributed. But around the world, like in the US, we estimate the buffers were worth about 15% of annual household income. And as a measure of in the US, I think we had our peak in the consumer savings buffers of about 11 to 12%. Of annual household incomes. In Europe, we estimate they're around about 5% of annual household income. So we had particularly large buffers in Australia simply because our cities were locked down in incredibly austere ways. Melbourne, one of our cities, had the longest lockdowns of any city on the planet. And then we had because we were running budget surpluses or a budget balance at the federal level, our fiscal purse was rich and full, care of commodity price revenues and royalties. And so governments were very, very generous. But then that poses a tremendous challenge to policy because tight interest rates have to battle the specter of a much higher than expected consumer spending. And we've seen that play out. So I think we are now into that second phase of the cycle where the politicians are starting to resist where they can the impact of some of these more severe monetary policy settings. But I will say that I think high inflation is very politically unpopular. And ultimately, that'll be the disciplining influence on politicians. And we've seen that in the UK with Truss. You know, Truss comes out and tries to, I think, commit to something in the order of 39 billion sterling worth of unfunded spending. And the bond market bandits had their day and removed a British prime minister and forced the government to bend the knee. So I think ultimately, rationality in markets will prevail.
We can but hope. You know, it's interesting because you talked earlier on about the necessary changes in allocations for investors. And you, when you go from a low interest rate, low inflation environment to a high interest rate, high inflation environment, I mean, by definition, it's such a 180-degree pivot that just about everything in your portfolio no longer works because those environments are so diametrically opposed. So when you talk about cash being king and arguably the best performing asset, certainly over the last year, and likely it's going to continue that, how do you think about the way to readjust your portfolio allocations? Because there's a sense that there's a need to do it quickly, and that could obviously lead to severe disruptions in particular asset classes. You mentioned equities being extremely overvalued. How do you think about rebalancing your portfolio to account for these new allocation requirements?
Yeah, I mean, let's just talk about equities for a moment. Like the S&P 500, last time I looked, was trading on a cyclically adjusted price earnings multiple of 31 times. Now, over the data we have available via the Nobel Prize winner, Robert Shiller, since 1880, the mean and median cyclically adjusted PE for the S&P 500 has been, I think, 15 to 17 times. When we model that and we say to ourselves, well, how does US equities perform in the decade after the PE piercing 30 times, and we're at circa 31 right now, what we find is that in that next 10 years, equities most of the time gives you negative to zero returns adjusted for inflation. So it's not a good place to be. And when we look at the relationship between US equity PEs and core inflation in the US, it's a very strong relationship over that same horizon. And what we find is that, you know, with US core inflation at 4 to 5%, you would expect equity PEs to be at around 15 times, not 31 times. So there are these really large dichotomies in asset pricing. Again, I'd stress, you know, single B-rated high-yield bond spreads in the US, which are the benchmark for global high yield, trading at about 400 over US treasuries. Normally, they trade at, you know, through the cycle at about 550 over US treasuries. So that's a very, very skinny risk premium. But in a crisis, specifically in a default cycle, we'd expect high yield to be paying us somewhere between 750 and 1,500 over the US treasuries. And that's been true in every default cycle, 2002, 2008, 2011, 12, 15, 16, and 2020. And this cycle looks like it will be the worst, as I mentioned earlier, since 2008. And of course, if listed equities are mispriced, that means that our private equity and venture capital is mispriced. You mentioned, you know, the cap rates or the, you know, the IRRs that commercial real estate continues to trade on, particularly office property, you know, totally untenable. Normally, office property will pay you a risk premium of 3 to 5% over government bonds. So really, to rationalize those exposures, you want yields of close to 10%. And many major developed markets, certainly if we look at A-grade office property in, say, Australia, you know, still trading on a cap rate that is actually in line with a 10-year government bond yield. It makes no sense at all. So I think that one thing we need to understand is these are very, very slow-moving processes, and we do, on the one hand, have some time. You want to avoid illiquidity like the plague and search for liquidity, because that liquidity crucially begets optionality. When asset classes do properly re-rate, which will, I think, take many years in some sectors, we want to be able to pounce like panthers. And that's what liquidity provides. And I think a lot of people have underestimated that value. I think in terms of portfolio construction, it's complicated because within my market, the fixed income market, you know, I'm not a huge fan right now of corporate bonds because they're exposed to the default cycle. They're very pro-cyclical. I think, you know, high yield's a disaster. It's extremely illiquid. There's no secondary trading. And that's, by the way, you know, you might ask the question, well, Chris, why are those high yield bond spreads so tight? Why haven't they repriced? Because there's no trading. It's the same reason why commercial properties ostensibly trading on these tight yields, they're not really trading on those tight yields. It's not being marked properly because no commercial properties are trading in many markets because they're inherently illiquid. And that's also true of private credit. So I think when I look at fixed income, I don't like corporate credit, even if it's high grade. I definitely don't like high yield, which I think is a disaster because, you know, we're going through the biggest default cycle since the GFC. I think private credit is enormously problematic because these are non-bank lenders that are providing finance. And their reason for being, which they'll advertise and have marketed for over a decade, is they provide finance to companies that couldn't get loans from banks. That's the very definition of subprime corporate finance. But no one ever asked the question, why aren't banks lending to these companies? And for very good reason, because the regulators after the 08 crisis said, hey, we want you to stop lending to dodgy borrowers. And they vacated that space, and into the breach stepped non-bank lenders in the form of an explosion of private credit. Now, most of these funds never existed prior to 2008. Most of these guys haven't been through a proper default cycle. And I think that space is highly problematic. The only sectors of the fixed income market I like are very high-grade bank bonds, partly because financial spreads are relatively very cheap compared to corporate spreads and high yield and private credit. So that's the first point. The second point is that high-grade banks tend to be either explicitly and or implicitly government guaranteed. So you've actually got on senior bonds very, very low to non-existent risks of default. If we look at Credit Suisse, I mean, we were short-selling Credit Suisse senior bonds in 2022. We had a blanket ban on long exposures to Credit Suisse in May 2021. I wrote to Australia's richest individual who shifted $1 billion to Credit Suisse's private bank in early 2021. I wrote to his team five times saying, get out of Credit Suisse, because we thought there were structural problems. But when Credit Suisse actually failed, its equities were hammered. Ironically, the capital structure was inverted and its so-called additional tier one capital hybrid securities were completely wiped out. But crucially, and this is really key, crucially, Credit Suisse's subordinated tier two bonds were 100% protected. Credit Suisse's senior bonds were 100% protected. Credit Suisse's deposits were 100% protected. And the interesting thing, you know, one of the corollaries of Silicon Valley and Silvergate and Credit Suisse is all this has done is widen the government guarantees globally of bank deposits, firstly. And then secondly, regulators around the world are only forcing banks with some ferocity to increase their liquidity and increase their capital and just make them much safer. And that then is a net transfer of wealth up the capital structure. It's a transfer of wealth from bank shareholders to bank bondholders. So it means lower bank return on equity, but at the same time, bondholders get even lower probability of defaults. The day that UBS announced the market, on that Monday morning, they bought Credit Suisse, its share price fell 16%. And UBS's senior bond spreads blew out to 350 over bunds. Now, we had traded billions of dollars of UBS paper. They were our number one bank credit in Europe. We loved UBS. And when we looked at that deal, Grant, basically UBS was taking out its number one competitor. It was becoming a monopolist in Switzerland. It was buying Credit Suisse for cents on the dollar. We estimated that they were buying it 20 to 30 billion Swiss franc cheap. UBS has subsequently said that they bought it 37 billion Swiss francs cheap. That's the gain they've recognized on the acquisition. And from our perspective, the Swiss Central Bank was giving UBS 150 billion Swiss francs of basically free loans, plus the Swiss state was guaranteeing 9 billion of losses on Credit Suisse. And if they were rolled gold government guaranteed before this, they're even more government guaranteed after the event, as the last remaining systematically important bank in Switzerland. So we then went out and bought $600 million of their senior bonds over that Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. So UBS senior bonds, even today, look super cheap. They're trading wide of BNP, trading wide of HSBC. I'd much rather own UBS senior paper than HSBC paper, which is a bit of a basket case, and notwithstanding that we have many great relationships at HSBC. So I like high-grade financial bonds. I love cash. And I also think there is a case for averaging in to fixed rate bonds. And what I mean by that is starting to introduce portfolio exposures to duration. Owning fixed rate bonds in 2021 was, you know, we argued going to be catastrophic. As sure as the sun sets in the West, returns to fixed rate bonds in FY22 were the worst in 100 years, as we had these huge increases in interest rates and the value of fixed rate bonds plummeted, you know, by 10 to 20% in many cases. But with 10-year government bond yields in the US having risen from circa 0.5% at the nadir of the pandemic all the way up to 4.3% today, we think that averaging into duration makes some sense. So I think that there are really interesting opportunities. I think people need to be courageous and crystallize losses or exit from potentially illiquid investments that are only likely to get worse in that search for risk-free yield. Because that's what's happened here. We've moved from a period or a regime where we were reaching for risk in the search for yield, and we now face the advent of very high risk-free yields, which are very, very attractive.
Couldn't agree more. That was beautifully put. When you looked at the Credit Suisse, the situation of Credit Suisse, obviously, and you were worried about that, when you look across the pond at something like Citigroup, you look at Schwab, which I think is something that has perhaps caught a lot of people by surprise. They don't kind of think of Schwab perhaps in the right way. Do you see anything there that echoes your concerns about Credit Suisse? Because again, these are systemically important institutions, but as they said in The Wizard of Oz, we're not in Kansas anymore. And it may well be that as they let Credit Suisse go, or they've forced the merger with Credit Suisse, do you see any risk of that kind of thing happening anywhere else around the world, particularly in the US?
Yeah, so I would say a few things. Firstly, a sine qua non or condition precedent of our investment process is we require extremely strong liquidity. So we only invest in ultra-high grade credit, and we tend to focus on too big to fail concerns or systematically important institutions. And one of the things we've avoided like the plague is conglomerates, so big global insurers or conglomerate banks like, you know, HSBC. We haven't allocated capital to HSBC for years because we've had concerns about China, Hong Kong, the US, UK, and of course Brexit. And we've also avoided like the plague, ostensibly non-systematically important investment banks, which are expendable, you know, the Deutsches, the Credit Suisses of the world. So I have no doubt that there'll be other casualties along the way. But one thing I would say is it's important to understand the antecedents of this particular mini banking crisis. As much as we were short selling Credit Suisse bonds in 2022 and had a ban on long exposures in 2021, make no mistake that by 2023, Credit Suisse, as far as I was concerned and my team was concerned, was just a dud investment bank. You know, just a kind of bog standard, boring, average investment bank that didn't really have much edge in our view. And we had zero interest in allocating capital to it. But there was nothing actually really wrong with Credit Suisse. There were no massive, you know, sure, they fucked up with Greensill and in their prime broking business, and they were real red flags. But I think they were reforming themselves. You know, there was lots of important remediation underway, and there were no credit events, excuse the pun, with Credit Suisse that were the catalyst for this crisis. So what was the catalyst for the crisis? The catalyst for the crisis was this innovation that you would describe as a high-velocity digital deposit run. And with Silicon Valley, we discovered for the first time in banking history that on a single day, $42 billion of deposits could rush out the door. And banks and regulators had always assumed that these deposits would be stickier and more inert. And because banks borrow short and lend long, they run fundamental asset liability mismatches that basically mean their business models are fatally flawed. And that's precisely what requires a range of different things. Firstly, it requires more or less an unlimited government guarantee of their deposits. So in the crisis, you know, government guarantees of bank deposits were more or less unconditional. They were paid back after the crisis. It requires unlimited liquidity guarantees from central banks. And then it often requires other extraordinary measures, such as, you know, term lending facilities that central banks all rolled out during the pandemic, explicit government guarantees of senior ranking bank bonds, as we saw emerge in 2008, so on and so forth. But the issue here was, as soon as we realized that the emergence of digitized banking meant that you could have a speculative scaled run on a bank, that was a bit of a game changer, I think, for the policy architecture. It basically meant that the US, in the case of Silicon Valley, had to come out over that weekend. The Fed, the SEC, and Treasury came out and said, no depositor will lose money, which was an unconditional government guarantee of all their deposits, despite the fact that the vast majority were above the explicit $250,000 government guarantee that existed in the United States. So for me, that was the key insight. And there will be, you know, important long-run policy responses to that. So that will be more expansive government guarantees. It'll be much more liquidity held within bank treasuries. It will be probably even more capital to further delever and de-risk banks. And I do think it's important, your point, that there is a threshold beyond which you are too big to fail, and below which you're not. And we saw with Silicon Valley and Credit Suisse that they were below that threshold. So to be honest, mate, we don't focus on anyone who's not systematically important, and everything else is pretty much irrelevant to us. But I have no doubt that there'll be other potential casualties. And I do think we live in this new age where you can have fairly hyperbolic attacks on institutions that claim their scalps that are actually quite divorced from fundamentals. And I actually have another anecdote in this respect. So when Silicon Valley happened, we said to our clients, Credit Suisse is definitely next. That could have been cauterized immediately if the Swiss National Bank had simply said, or the Swiss government had simply come out and said, all Credit Suisse deposits are guaranteed. If the government says all Credit Suisse deposits are guaranteed, there never would have been a run on Credit Suisse. No one would have pulled their money out. If your money's risk-free, why would you remove it from Credit Suisse? But they didn't do that. And so actually, it was the policymakers who had introduced government guarantees in the GFC. There was an expectation that there was some sort of government guarantee that I think were ultimately culpable for the collapse of Credit Suisse, which had nothing to do with any fundamental credit concerns. After Credit Suisse failed, we said to clients, Deutsche's next. And, you know, you could see that the hedge funds had shifted to, you know, attacking Deutsche. And we actually, I think it was a Friday, we saw, you know, Deutsche's CDS spreads explode wider, their cash bond spreads explode wider, equities were in free fall. And I wrote to the ECB, I wrote to the global CEO, UK CEO, and Australian CEO, I think of DB, and I said, you guys really need to do a few things. And I actually published an article on it at the same time. And I contacted journalists at the Financial Times and at Bloomberg. And this is all in one single session. Because for me, this was the attack on Credit Suisse was purely contrived and it was purely speculative. And the attack on DB was going to be exactly the same thing. I said, point number one, the German state needs to come out and more or less unquestionably back DB. Point number two is that the ECB should investigate short selling of financial securities and look at a ban on short selling of financial securities. Now, in Europe, even to this day, you cannot short sell sovereign bonds on a naked basis, and that's a legacy of the GFC. And it was clear that for a trivial amount of money, you could short DB CDS, move that wider. That would kind of create contagion into DB bonds. So DB bond spreads would move wider for a slightly larger amount of money. You could short sell those securities. And then you'd probably have to expend even more on short selling DB equities. But the contagion was set. I think it was in the case of Credit Suisse, if I'm not mistaken, the short sellers, you know, the talk on the street was that the short sellers were massively manipulating the media. And they convinced, I think, Bloomberg to roll out a repeat of an article where the head of the Saudi National Bank, I think, said that they weren't prepared to commit any further capital to Credit Suisse beyond their 9.8% stake. And he did say in that interview that he was restating what he'd said in the past because they had regulatory limits on how much of Credit Suisse they could hold. And this was not new news, but I think that statement that day triggered a circa 30% collapse in Credit Suisse's share price. So I think, you know, we were not willing to partake in what we would regard as market manipulation. And it does make, I think, investments in the Charles Schwab's, the regional banks in the US and investment banks orders of magnitude riskier when you kind of take high velocity digital deposits that can be manipulated into rapidly exiting institutions with, you know, a chain reaction across the capital structure as a consequence.
These backstops, to your point, have grown in breadth and scope since 08, you know, and as you said, we had this almost blanket guarantee of all the US deposits, which was remarkable in the wake of Silicon Valley and Signature. Has that changed at all, do you think, given the fact that obviously the central banks are now underwater? We just saw this week the Bank of England needing a massive injection from the UK Treasury. They've lost, I think, in total now $30 billion of taxpayer money on the mark-to-market. The Swiss National Bank had a similar bad number in the last quarter. I know the RBA are in similar situations. How do these losses on these portfolios that were once touted as, you know, great sources of income for treasuries around the world, how does that change the kind of reaction function of these institutions, do you think, Chris?
Yeah, I think it's a fantastic question that everyone is puzzling over, and I'm not sure if I have any easy answers. All I would say is that as the central banks have torched their equity capital and torched tens of billions of dollars of taxpayer cash through investments in trillions of dollars of fixed rate bonds at 100-year lows in terms of interest rates, as part of the QE to infinity program during the pandemic, unambiguously, you know, has highlighted the costs of those initiatives, and I think really radically increased the hurdles for future policy. So I just think that it makes a lot of these unconventional policies far more unfashionable in the future than they have been in the past. I mean, QE was the policy choice of reflex after the 08 crisis, and it was rolled out to kind of serve as that perfect panacea for every problem. But, you know, suddenly when, you know, a combination of extreme fiscal and monetary stimulus engineered the mother of all inflation crises, the worst that we've seen since the, you know, 1980s. And now the costs of that inflation crisis are becoming much clearer through these radical increases in interest rates and slowly but surely the asphyxiation of the real economy. You know, I think you're seeing central bankers revisit these policies. And I know, you know, we've seen the RBA in Australia say that, you know, they wouldn't use a yield curve target again, say that they'd only use QE again very, very sparingly because of the costs. Interestingly, in Australia, the RBA is sitting on such massive mark-to-market losses on its circa $300 billion bond portfolio. It's been reluctant to realize those losses by selling bonds, as other central banks have done, like the New Zealanders. The New Zealanders were incredibly prescient. They preemptively secured a loss indemnity from their treasury. So they've been able to shrink their balance sheet very quickly, whereas the RBA has thus far proven much more reluctant to taper or shrink its balance sheet actively by active sales of the bonds because of its concerns about realizing these losses, which then shifts more of the weight of policy onto interest rates. I mean, the interesting thing in Australia, which is kind of curious, is historically the RBA has set interest rates about 160 basis points above the US Fed fund rate. And yet right now we sit at almost 150 basis points below Fed fund rate. And, you know, the RBA's cash rate's at 4.1%. It says neutral is 3.8. So we've got barely restrictive monetary policy in Australia. And yet we've got, you know, 8% unit labor cost growth. We've got higher services inflation than the US. We've got higher goods inflation than the US. We've got higher core inflation than the US. We've got as low an unemployment rate as the US. And obviously the Fed's at 525 to 550 and is running much, much tighter policy. So you've got this experiment being played by the RBA, and it's really interesting to see how it will unfurl. And you've suddenly now got a very weak Aussie dollar given the dramas in China, which, you know, for what it's worth, we've argued for over a decade that China's completely uninvestable because you have no property rights, you have no rule of law, and you have no real transparency or certainty in terms of investment activities, and clearly huge asymmetries in the treatment of insiders and outsiders. You know, we predicted years ago that you'd see selective defaults of Chinese issuers on their US dollar bonds, which is what we've seen. But yeah, I think your point about these losses now reverberating through time and impacting future policy choices is a really, really important one, because I think the universe of policies that central banks are willing to use in the future may be far more telescoped than what we've seen in the world, you know, after the GFC, where there was a plethora of new policies.
Yeah, we're running out of time, Chris. If you wouldn't mind, I can't leave without just getting a little update on Australia for you. It's something that I've covered a lot over the years. And so whenever I speak to guys down in Australia, even guys with a much more global bent like you, I'm always keen to just get a sense of where Australia is, given its kind of the strength of its economy for 30 plus years now. And obviously the strength of its housing market, both of which have clearly reached points where they are vulnerable or susceptible to significant potential downturns. Where are we with the Aussie economy, and where are we with housing? Just in a kind of nutshell, if you have a minute.
Yeah, sure. Firstly, it's wise to never underestimate what the economist calls the wonder down under. It's like, you know, betting against the miracle of US immigration and productivity growth and innovation. So Australia's in a really, really interesting position. For 30 years, we ran more or less the strongest population growth in the OECD. We have these huge natural endowments of resources that have given us massive budget surpluses. We're now, you know, running current account surpluses because we're lending to the rest of the world through our huge superannuation system, which is, you know, over $3 trillion in size. Australians are now forced to invest 11.5% of their annual income, their annual labour income, into a pension system known as superannuation, which is becoming incredibly influential domestically and globally, and actually really changing the balance of power in terms of the polity through the influence of those massive capital flows and what they can do in terms of exposures to and investments in infrastructure and other forms of capital spending and their control of corporate Australia. We've had a resurgence in population growth after the borders opened, you know, the strongest immigration in 20 years. The housing market in late 2021, we were the first analyst to come out and basically say we thought Aussie house prices would have to adjust 15 to 25% down in nominal terms after the RBA started lifting rates, which we expected in mid-22. The RBA started in May 22. In our modelling, we penciled in a 4.25 RBA cash rate. They've got to 4.10. Aussie house prices fell in nominal terms 10%. Inflation adjusted terms, they fell 15%. That correction in Aussie house prices, that 10% drawdown, is the second largest in 40 years. But they have surprised us in 2023 with a fairly firm bounce. What is interesting about the bounce in Aussie house prices in 2023 is that it has synchronized very closely with the bounce in global house prices. We see this in New Zealand, okay, US, Canada, Norway, and other countries. And it's that risk-related bid that we talked about earlier, whereby, you know, I think a lot of people thought the hiking cycle was dead at the start of the year. Central banks had reached their terminal cash rate. You know, we could thread the needle to a soft landing, Goldman Sachs style, which many people, I think, still advocate and believe in. And so you get back on the bid, which we're not as convinced by, obviously. So the housing market, you know, continues to climb higher. That suggests that policy is not tight enough. Again, we have the unemployment rate, you know, way below the RBA's estimates of the full employment rate. We have the strongest unit labor cost growth in the developed world. We have very, very elevated services inflation. And the RBA is running this experiment where its cash rate is much lower than its peers. So it's at 4.1. As I mentioned, you know, the RBNZ's at 5.5, the Canadians are at 5, the Brits are at, you know, 5.25, the Fed's at 5.25 to 5.5. Everyone's fitting, it seems, into the mid fives to high fives. And the ECB's at 4.3 going higher. And so it's hard not to think that the RBA is going to be forced to mean revert. The other thing I'd say about Australia is, you know, you'd have to think that the China trade, in terms of the providence that's bequeathed to Australia in the form of seemingly never-ending demand for coal and iron ore, is possibly running its course as, you know, China's population starts to shrink and they start to exhaust many of their natural sources of policy stimulus. So I think that's negative for the Australian economy. And I also would say that years of providence, you know, vis-a-vis our resources endowments, has engendered a lot of policy complacency in Australia, particularly the state government level. So our state governments are running massive budget deficits. In the states with resource endowments like Queensland and Western Australia, they're still running budget surpluses, but they're pretty much spending all of those gains. And so I do think Australia has a problem with productivity. People are, I think, complacent. You know, most folks under the age of 40 in Australia, it's amazing to think that in Australia in 2008, our unemployment rate peaked in the high fives. We did not have two quarters of negative GDP growth in Australia. Till the pandemic came along, Australia hadn't had a recession since 1991. And so, you know, adversity obviously forges great strength, and Australians have not experienced that economic adversity really since 1991, given the pandemic was all but a blip for many people. So I think there are a lot of risks that lie in wait for the Aussie economy. But having said all of the above, we still do have super strong population growth. You know, iron ore prices remain elevated, as do coal prices. Natural gas is obviously another key export. We do have a valuable antipodal position where we're well situated to service, you know, the high growth Asian economies. But I think there's tremendous political and policy complacency in Australia that it does not augur well.
That's beautifully done in a short 5-minute space of time. Listen, Chris, this has been so enjoyable for me. I've really, really thoroughly enjoyed every minute of this conversation. Before we wrap up, if you wouldn't mind, just let the listeners know how they can find out more about you, about Coolabah, about your writings in the AFL, all that good stuff.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity to engage with you, Grant. I often listen to the podcast, and this is a privilege. You can find out a little bit more about, I guess, my stuff on Twitter at CJOYE, about the business at CoolabahCapital.com. And then I write for the Australian Financial Review, which is AFR.com. And then I think a more accessible subscription-free site that I write for is called LiveWire Markets. I believe it's LiveWireMarkets.com or .com.au, but I write there also, you know, every other day. Yeah, so thank you for the time, mate. Great chatting, and hopefully we can do it again.
I would look forward to it. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Graham.
Well, there you have it, folks. My thanks to Chris Joy for his time. So that was such an enjoyable conversation for me. And I really appreciated not just Chris's perspective, but his ability to frame and communicate his views on what is an increasingly complex world. Again, just to reiterate, Chris's website is Coolabah Capital. That's Coolabah capital.com. And his Twitter feed is at CJoy. That's CJoye. And you can also read Chris's contributions to the Australian Financial Review at AFR.com and to LiveWire Markets at LiveWireMarkets.com. That's all from me. My thanks to Chris. I will see you again with another conversation in the not too distant future. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.